The views and opinions of this program are those of its hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
Hello, KKFI listeners, and welcome to the Sandra Moran Alphabet Soup Radio Book Club, this week's edition of The 10th Voice. This is a special bonus episode because we have five Saturdays in the month. I'm Fiona Nowling, here with my wife and co-hostess Una Nowling.
Hello.
Behind the board today is our sound engineer and producer, Linda Wilson. With us in the studio today, we have Tessa Grattan, a local queer author from Lawrence. She's the author of the Blood Journal series and Gods of New Asgard series, co-author of young adult writing books, The Curiosities and The Anatomy of Curiosity, as well as dozens of short stories available in anthologies and on merryfates.com. Her current projects include Season 2 of Tremontaine at Serial Box Publishing and The Queens of Innes Lear coming in 2018 from Tor. Una will finish up the show with the community calendar update, but first, she will take a look at some of the LGBT news of the week. Thank you, Una. And again, with us in the studio today, we have Tessa Grattan, a local queer author from Lawrence. She's the author of the Blood Journal series and Gods of New Asgard series, as well as a plethora of short stories available in anthologies and on merryfates.com. Tessa, welcome to The 10th Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
We're very pleased to have you. Now, starting at the beginning, how did you get started as a writer?
Wow. At the very beginning, I have always loved books. I was a very early reader. My whole family are readers. And I started telling stories to myself, like most kids do when they're playing with their friends or with their toys. And I don't really remember at what point I realized that I should start writing these stories down. It may have been one of the times I came home from school and I was telling my mom a story about the dragons I met on my walk. And she must have said something about, that sounds like a good story, you should write that down. And so I started writing stories, and I did that when I was finished with my schoolwork, hiding my stories from my teacher, though eventually they found them and encouraged me completely. So I've really always been a writer. It didn't translate into wanting to be a writer as a job. I was always told by my parents that I needed to have health insurance. And health insurance was not something that really came along with being a writer. So I looked around at a lot of different ideas. You know, I was always creative, always writing. And when I was, I was 13 or 14, we actually moved to Japan because my father was in the Navy. And I fell into the base, the Navy base. They had a community theater, and I really got involved in that. And I sort of dropped writing for a while and just became completely overwhelmingly enamored with the theater and performing and that kind of storytelling. And I came back to the United States my junior year of high school, and I just knew that theater was my destiny. And I went, we moved back here to Kansas City, which is where my family is from. And we came, I attended St. Teresa's Academy here in Missouri, and it's an all-girls Catholic college prep school, and they had a wonderful drama program, and I absolutely loved it, but I was also studying everything that I was interested in. You know, I was a world traveler, and I had a very wide appreciation for learning and science, which I got from my parents, and so I slowly started to realize that theater was perhaps even more precarious a career aspiration than writing. And so when I went to college originally at the K-State in Manhattan, I just was an English major and looking around trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life, and still always writing short stories, but it wasn't a career. I didn't want to be a published author except as an aside. Eventually, I found women's studies and gender studies. I transferred to the University of Sunderland in England and then back to the University of Kansas in Lawrence. And that is where it was women's studies now then, but now I think they call it gender and sexuality studies, the Department of Gender and Sexuality Studies. But in 2000, it was just women's studies. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely loved it. It gave me a point of view from which I could analyze everything and anything. So I could look at literature, I could look at theater, I could look at science, I could look at history from this perspective of feminism. And it, again, just like I had had this awakening with theater, I had a new awakening with feminism. And I went to graduate school for women's studies at the University of Cincinnati. And this was in 2003 is when I graduated with my bachelor's from the University of Kansas. And so from 2003 to 2005, I was in Cincinnati. And oh, wow, did I find the 2004 presidential election traumatic. I know a lot of people did. My dad was deployed to Iraq at the time, and I was an absolute mess of emotions and, you know, my understanding about the world and how the world viewed me and viewed my community and how I really wanted to change the world. And it was not happening. It was frustrating. Everything that I tried, everything that my friends tried was so fractured and nothing worked. And in the wake of the re-election of George W. Bush, I just was completely distraught with all of my life choices. I was 24 and like my life was over. I couldn't figure out what to do. And I quit my graduate classes and I cast around for what to take. And I landed sort of randomly on Old English translation classes because I'd always loved language and writing. And this gave me an opportunity to study something new and in depth that meant something to me because it was poetry, I could think about it from a feminist perspective, which was encouraged by my professor, without actively engaging in politics, which was so crushing. And I thought back, along all of the long, long years of my life, and I realized that there was one thing that had always made me want to work harder to understand other people, to change the world, to make the world better. And the thing that had changed me the most were the books that I read, particularly when I was young. The books that introduced me to people who weren't like me, to places that weren't the places that I was familiar with. And I don't just mean, some of the literature from other countries, but fantasy literature and science fiction literature. And I thought to myself, well, you've always been a writer. Maybe you should, sink into this and try and make that the way that you can change the world because you find politics so crushing. And so that is what I did. My wife, she was not that at the time. This was 2005. She agreed to move home to my home in Lawrence, Kansas. And I gave myself 5 years to focus on becoming a published writer, to make that my career, while I was going to have, just whatever job I could find to pay our rent and support our partnership. And so I wrote 3 books over the course of about 4 years, and I revised them and discarded them and, you know, wrote another one. And eventually I wrote a 4th novel, and I thought it was ready, and I sent it out to agents and eventually got an agent, and that book became my debut novel. And it was a young adult novel, primarily because that was my focus at the time, because of that realization I'd had that the books I'd read when I was 13 to 16 had so incredibly changed my worldview.
And which was that book?
That was Blood Magic. It came out in 2011 with Random House Children's Books.
That's the first of the Blood Journals books.
Correct.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The Blood Journals are gothic, horror, romance, young adult novels. The first one, Blood Magic, takes place in Missouri, and it's about 2 teenagers who discover that they have a family history with it's blood magic. It requires their blood to enact the power, but it is based on a lot of different American folklore, and I tried to ground it in real, like, American flavor. And, you know, there's murder and zombie possums and body snatching and kissing and a lot of graveyards in that first book. And the second one, The Bloodkeeper, I moved to Kansas. I moved the story to Kansas. And it's a companion novel. So it takes place, I think, 6 or 7 years after the first one. And while the characters from the first are in it, they're not the main characters. It's 2 new teenagers here in Kansas, one of whom is a local witch who's grown up with magic, and she absolutely loves it and is very connected to the prairie and the land there, and another who's a newcomer.
I just have to say, you had me at zombie possums in Blood Magic. I'm going to have to read that one first.
I learned to pitch that in particular at a middle school where I was giving a book talk once. I was trying to get these kids interested in the story, and just, you know, some of them were definitely into it, but it took me till I thought, oh, I should tell them about the zombie possums, and then, like, all, like, 50 of them, their eyes just lit up, and I thought, I have to go there first next time.
One of the questions I was going to ask is how you publicize your book and how you pick which bits as a hook to read to them. And it obviously sounds like you picked the zombie possum's hook.
That is true, though I don't generally do readings when I go to a school. When I'm doing a school visit, I have found that it works better for me to engage the kids and the teenagers just as myself, and talk about the world and talk about how I write and why I write and what my books are about, less than just reading, because they can read them on their own if they're interested, but the kids are really interested in the world and my world and what I do.
That makes sense. You've told us a bit about the Blood Journals. I have to say, I really like the world building and the ideas behind the United States of Asgard series. So can you tell us about how you came up with that?
I sure can. I've actually already begun that story. It came to me for the first time when I was taking my old English translation classes. The university was on a trimester schedule, and the third trimester of that particular class was just translating Beowulf. And so somewhere in a notebook in one of my closets, I have my own translation of Beowulf, which is an old English epic poem. And I was doing this in the spring of 2005, and the media at that time was just inundated always with support our troops. And, you know, we're still at war. We've been at war in Afghanistan for 16 years, but it was still relatively new, and people talked about it in the media all the time, unlike now. You have to go looking for news from Afghanistan now. But the way that it was discussed in, you know, in politics and on the news sounded so much like what I was reading in my old English poetry classes. And I thought to myself, wow, America is really still a war culture. We still value war. We value glory and honor. We value so many of these things. And the way we tell stories about it is very similar. And this really makes me angry. And one of the things, the most fascinating things about Beowulf is that it's about pagans. The story supposedly took place around 400, the year 400 CE, and it was told over centuries and then probably written down by two or three different Christian monks. And so you have several layers of perspective, and the Christian perspective overlaid over this pagan poetry and pagan culture really brings up a lot of the shadows and the shadowy places where Christianity has become a religion of war in a lot of its language in America, and it was then. I'd been trying to write a thesis about religion and politics and feminism. And so I really wanted to write a book about religion and politics in America and feminism and probably dragons. And
of course, it's always got to be dragons.
Well, so it's, you may know, it's very difficult to have a conversation about religion and politics at the dinner table or with friends or anywhere. And I thought perhaps if I know I'm talking about Christian war culture, but what I'm pretending to talk about is Norse mythology, maybe nobody will get angry right away and they'll actually read the book and we can have conversations and I can tell a story that is about American religion and war and people will love it instead of be like, oh gosh, that's that author. Don't invite her over. You definitely don't want to read that book because it's just going to make you angry. And so I conceived of the United States of Asgard, which is an alternate America founded by Vikings and their gods. So it is a fantasy. The gods are real. They walk among us. Trolls are real. It's modern, though. It takes place in an alternate sort of Midwest, and there are, you know, muscle cars and high school and cell phones, but also there's a unit of the Asgard army dedicated to eradicating trolls from the Rocky Mountains, and Valkyrie interfere with Congress so things actually get done, and, you know, that kind of thing. So they're road trip novels, and I had so much fun writing them because I get to write about trolls and teenagers and also a Jesus, but nobody calls me on it very often. Every once in a while.
Because this is the whole resurrection thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I did notice with the road trips, you got to include another interest of yours, paleontology, because the Dragonbone Cliff.
Yes, I did. There's one of the novellas where they go to Dinosaur National Monument in Colorado, but in the United States of Asgard, I can't remember what they call it. Is it just Dragon National Monument?
Dragon, yeah.
Because they have dragons. They originally, the people who first discovered dinosaur bones assumed they were dragons. And so similarly to how we called dinosaurs lizards for so long, they called them dragons, extinct dragons, and the name just stuck. So I did get to have a lot of fun with that. And the trolls are mountain trolls, and they also get to let me play with a lot of geology and fun science and things.
How do you get other interests into the books? Or do you get interested in things because you want to take an idea and then you go and research it and find it's fun?
Oh, both, definitely. Frequently, so I tend to think about books before I start writing them, anywhere from a year to about 8 years, just depending on the urgency of the story, how much research I need to do, and exactly how exhausted I am from my last series. I did research for the United States of Asgard for at least 5 years before I really started writing it, but I was writing I wrote the Blood Journals books while I was doing research, building the huge world of the United States of Asgard. And so a lot of times you just, like, I knew I wanted to dig into Viking history because Vikings were so similar to this ideal of the American dream, you know, is very much about if you earn it, you can have it. And so I read and read and read all of the Norse archaeology and mythology and history that I could find. And so I started to know the feel for the culture and the poetry. And at that point, I could narrow it down to, okay, these are the kinds of characters I want to start with so I could focus my research. But while I was focusing on, say, the berserkers, there's a berserker character, and those are warriors who are touched by God, and they go absolutely wild when they end up in battle and are nearly undefeatable. When I was doing research on that, I came across the research or the what we think we know about Viking magic, and even older, before they were really Vikings, older Norse mythology. And they had magic that was called seether, and it was very gendered. And of course, I immediately was more intrigued because it was gendered primarily female, and there are all these hints that if a man used or performed a prophecy, like used the different kinds of tools they had for throwing prophecies, then he was considered lesser and not masculine. And that is how I ended up creating my prophet character, was because I happened upon this and then dug more into that. So it's usually very much both things that I know I'm interested in researching and things that I can just let myself research, with things that I'm like, oh shoot, I really have to know more about this before I write a book that has anything to do with it.
Thank you, Tessa. That's sure. Very cool. Now, we need to take a short break for music and for a station announcement, and then we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Tenth Voice, and we're here with Tessa Grattan. And that was Kappa Kaylee, a Scottish group, and the song was Waiting for the Wheel to Turn. And I heard that more years ago than I would like to think about when I was at university. So while we're talking about music, it might be a daft question, but a lot of fantasy authors I've read recently publish a playlist of songs they were listening to when they were writing the book. So do you have a playlist when you're writing, and does it differ depending on what you're working on?
I absolutely do have music when I'm writing, and it must differ depending on my project. I tend to build my playlists during the brainstorming phase, and I have a dog, and so I take him for a walk every morning and put on the playlist of whatever I'm going to be working on primarily that day. And my playlists tend to have up to 60 or 75 songs on them, because I'm just gathering music that makes me feel the way I want a particular scene to feel, or that reminds me of a character. And so they're very unpleasant, I suspect, for other people to listen to, and because they don't have a flow like an album or a playlist that has a theme. Every once in a while, I have a book where I think I could present the playlist and someone else would find it pleasing. My next young adult fantasy is called Strange Grace, and it comes out in next summer of 2018. And that playlist is bizarrely cohesive, because I knew exactly what I wanted the whole book to feel like. And the three main characters were always very much like a triad in their relationships on every level. And so that playlist is great, but the U.S. Asgard playlist is an absolute mess, because there's so many different kinds of American music and music rooted to different places in America and different kinds of people. So I just have, it's chaos. And my Queens of Innes Lear, which is my adult fantasy debut that comes out next year and I'm very excited about. It's a King Lear, a feminist fantasy retelling of King Lear. And there's some music, like some Celtic music, mostly modern stuff that reminds me of like old-timey Shakespeare. And then some really modern stuff too, because my point of view is modern. And so I have a very modern take on a lot of the characters and themes of the book. So sometimes I listen when I'm actually writing, but usually I pick one song and put that one song on repeat to keep the tone that I'm working with in that particular scene right there in my body.
So you said that your new Innes Lear is a feminist take on King Lear.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed you play with gender roles in others of your books. Like, without too many spoilers, you have a feminist female berserker, which is usually male, and Fenris Wolf is female as well. How does your perspective as a queer author and your gender studies influence your view on things?
Well, I've known for a long time, like many people in the queer community, that gender is not a binary. And so before I even started writing books, I had a different perspective of gender than most of my readers, and most of the people around me who weren't in a queer community. And that is something that I was also trained to look for in my feminist studies, was to look at what is this short story saying about gender in this short story. What do we want to take away from it? What did the author want to take away from it? What are the problematic ways, you know, that gender is represented in this story and how it relates to the history of, you know, this place and time and author, like all of these different complicated things. And so gender is one of the first things that I, at this point in my life, instinctually want to play with or explore, especially as a fantasy writer, because I have room to build worlds where people and culture are not built the way our culture is built. And so I feel like it's my responsibility not to default to a gender binary when I'm writing a story, even if it is an alternate history of America. If, you know, I need to look at what Vikings may or may not have thought about gender roles, and then, you know, extrapolate and do what I want with them. And the Fenris Wolf is a really good example, because the Fenris Wolf, in everything I've ever seen in Norse mythology, is gendered male. He's a monster. He's a son of Loki, who is a god of mischief and also kind of considered a monster, and a troll monster, or a giant, I think. And Fenris's destiny is to destroy the world. Fenris will get so large and so hungry that he will devour the sun and start Ragnarok. And when I was first doing a lot of my world building, there's the Norse mythology is very, very masculine, which is another thing that made it really easy to sort of fit onto American culture, because we are a patriarchy.
Yes.
And so were the Vikings, though they had different nuances, of course, with their laws and gender roles. And so the vast majority of the gods and the characters in these stories are male, and I immediately tried to look for some who would be easy to pull away from a real, like, definitive masculinity. And there were some, like Loki and Odin, who are very, very gender fluid in how they have presented for thousands of years and their roles in society. And there's actually a lot of suggestion that Loki was turned into a bad guy of Norse mythology because he was so genderqueer.
I noticed that it's okay in the stories for him to be genderqueer and even to mother rather than fathering children, but they mock Thor when he had to be dressed up to try and get some item back from the giant dressed as a woman. It's totally wrong and mocked and a story he's ashamed of and that's always told to annoy him.
Yep. And, you know, we don't really know when these stories became, you know, when did that version of that story become the dominant one that was told? What power dynamics were going on in the culture at that time that made some of these stories shift from being much more, I'm not sure accepting is the right word, but more open to a gender queer god, and then started to very specifically and purposefully define them along their patriarchal gender roles. And we don't really know exactly. This is such a... it's very easy to get me to turn into a nerd about Norse mythology now. But so the Fenris wolf, I looked at this and I thought, this is a man monster. It's in everything. But what I want to talk about is hunger and destructive hunger and the kinds of hunger and passion that society restricts, because the most famous story of the Fenris wolf is how the gods bound him with a silver collar made of impossible things and tricked him into putting it on. And so that's the point, is that the gods were so desperate to keep the Fenris wolf's hunger from growing that they chained him. And I thought, well, obviously in the United States of Asgard, I'm going to make this a teenage girl. Because if there's one thing American culture likes to do, it's put chains on the passions and hungers of teenage girls. And so for me, that was an easy transition for my needs as a writer and as a queer person to make. But it was a much harder one from the mythology. It didn't come very naturally from that story. So I had to work really hard to, you know, make that change and then see how it would ripple out in the story. But I love my Fenris. She's probably my favorite character in that whole series. So, not to play favorite, but...
I was going to ask you before if you had a favorite series or a favorite story or a favorite character, or if it's like choosing between your children, a favorite child, but it sounds like you do.
I don't have children, but I like to think that it's very different from choosing between your children, because there comes a point where I actually hate all of my books and I never want to talk about them again, and I don't like any of it, so I usually get over it. But I hope that that is very different from having children. I suspect that it is. But I do have favorites. I do have, like, Fenris. I love Fenris, and I love Josephine Darley the most from the Blood Journals. She is, in fact, the bad guy. And gosh, I do always have favorite characters that I like to write about or I'm the most intrigued by. And usually they're going to be someone the story centers around, because why would I tell a story about someone tertiary to the person I'm most interested in or most passionate about?
Now, you also have an awful lot of short stories, and a lot of authors just stick to either short stories or to novels and can't handle the shift in length or maybe even the shift in voice. So tell me about The Merry Sisters of Fate and your short stories.
So I do consider myself to be a novelist, because I prefer that medium. I prefer the length. I love being able to explore to my heart's content and then have an editor help me pare back. Short stories, I think, are fascinating and so, so different because unlike a novel where you can explore your question from so many different perspectives, in a short story, you really just have an ask and answer or an ask and ... And that's the main difference for me when I'm writing a short story versus beginning the process of writing a novel. And when I was first, it was 2008, I believe, or 2009, when my two, at the time, critique partners and I began this website called MaryFates.com, we were really just trying to get better at writing novels. And so one of the women, her name's Maggie Stiefvater, she was a portrait artist, and she did a project called A Portrait a Day, or A Painting a Day, and for 365 days, she created a piece of art from beginning to end. And at the end of that year, she was so amazed at how much better she was. She thought, surely there's a way to do this with stories, with writing. But we knew that a story a day was absolutely wild and impossible. And so we decided to try and write a short story every week and post it on the internet so we had no excuses. And so, and that's basically what we did. And so for over three years, I wrote about 75 short stories. The first year we did it every week. And then after that, we did it twice a month. And then for the last 6 months or so, it was just once a month because we slowly realized it was too hard to keep up. And most of those stories are not good. They are still on the internet because they're part of my process and part of my history. And someday they'll probably disappear, but not because I made them disappear. I'd say 10 of those 75 are actually short stories. The rest of them are like vignettes or moments in time or just me trying to figure out can I tell a story without any dialogue? Is that possible? Or other little challenges I gave to myself that I could then translate into novel writing. So that is also different from sitting down to really write a short story for an anthology. Like if I've been invited in to several anthologies, fairy tale retellings. And there's one that I just finished a story for called All Out, and it is queer stories by queer authors. They're historical stories. So any time in history to write adventures about queer people, because there were, of course, queer people throughout history. And so when I sit down to do that kind of thing, it's very different than that frantic, oh, shoot, I have to write a short story and post it on the internet by 5 o'clock today. but it's still just one question and a few little spirals to see if I can suggest maybe some answers about that question. And then the novels are whole conversations.
Do you try to keep the short stories separate from your novels, or do you let them bleed over for the ideas and characters?
Well, the themes always bleed over for me. That's just the nature of how I think. I very much welcome the pattern making that my brain likes to do with ideas, like to take disparate ideas and then find connections and see if I can create connections. And so I think it would actually be doing a disservice to my creative process if I tried too hard to pull stories apart if I'm writing them around the same time. I like to think that my ideas and themes develop as I move on, like the themes in Strange Grace and The Queens of Innes Lear coming out next year, I think are more developed than the themes and ideas in The United States of Asgard, partly because I've gotten better at thinking about them and thinking about story, and I've moved on from questions I had 6 years ago when I was writing those books. But there, you can still find connections. There's still going to be threads of the kinds of things I am interested in as a human being, primarily power and where that comes from and how we choose our reactions to power. So all of I was starting to say the Strange Grace and the Queens of Innisfallir. One is a standalone young adult novel, and the other is a fantasy retelling of King Lear, but they're also kind of both about the same thing. So
I know that's your first adult novel. Is that so that you can look at things and explore them differently, or why the move to adults?
Partly because I've always wanted to write adult fantasy. That was my favorite genre to read for my entire life, and it really always has been. So I'm very glad to be able to move into that. But King Lear does not lend itself to a young adult retelling because it is such a mess of motivation and power and things that, you know, young adult novels really need to have a solid through line. You know, this happens and it leads to this and leads to this and leads to this, because that is part of the nature of the young adult category, is it, the pacing and the interiority needs to be very intimate to one or two characters. And for King Lear, I really needed to pull back from that intimate kind of interiority and explore this problem of toxic patriarchy from as many different entry points as I could. And the book itself the shape of it is not young adult. I don't know if that makes sense, but I think if you read young adult fantasy and adult fantasy, it would probably make sense.
One quick question, which is all we've got time for. Do you draw from current events in the news and make them into your characters or villains or anything in your books?
I do, but they don't usually show up for a few years. Like I said, it takes me a while to really let an idea percolate. The most recent, most salient example is in The Anatomy of Curiosity. The novella Desert Canticle is about it's about a war zone, and the main character is diffusing magical bombs after the war. And this was because I was obsessed for about a year with disposal units in Iraq who were having to go through and find all of the IEDs left over. And I read so many novels and nonfiction stories about this that it was just, I had to think about it on a story level myself. And so what did I do? I added magic. And then I wrote a story about magic bomb disposal.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. It was great.
Conversation. I'm going to finish up our hour here with a little bit of the community calendar and go through some of the top events. Every month, my wife Fiona leads the Kansas City SOFA support group for significant others, friends, family, and allies of transgender persons. They meet on the first and third Wednesday of the month in May. Those meetings will be at 6:30 on the 3rd and on the 17th in Study Room 115 at Leawood Pioneer Library. For driving directions and other SOFA information, you can visit transitcity.org/SOFFA. On the first Monday of the month, May 1st, UMKC Trans Plus Allies Group will be meeting at 6 p.m. in Room 402 at the UMKC Student Union. They will be hosting a discussion on mental health providers working with trans clients. For more information, you can visit the UMKC LGBTQIA page on Facebook. While you're there, you can also find information about the Lavender Graduates Banquet. Every Thursday, Transfinity KC will be rehearsing at the Country Club Congregational United Church of Christ at 205 West 65th Street in Kansas City, Missouri, starting at 7 p.m. All are welcome to join, including allies. There is an M2F support group at the Transgender Institute on the first and third Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. at 8080 Ward Parkway in Kansas City, Missouri. There is also an F2M support group, but the dates and times are changing, so if you're interested, you'll have to contact the Transgender Institute at 816-305-0943.